Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today I get to speak with Dr. Sri Padma, who is visiting professor at the University of Chicago and also affiliated with Bowdoin College. We're talking about an interesting publication of hers on the goddess. It's called Vicissitudes of the Goddess, Reconstructions of the Grama Devata in India's Religious Traditions. Sri, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your book about? Your book is about Grama Devatas. Maybe say a tiny word on what a Grama Devata is and the central thrust of your book.
Okay. What is Grama Devata? Grama Devata. Grama Devata is basically the translation of that is goddess of a village, any village. So Grama Devata basically is worshipped directly by devotees without any Brahmin priestly mediation and therefore without elaborate liturgical Sanskrit recitations. I'm saying this because usually people imagine Hindu temple, and when you go into the temple, they usually have Brahmin priest mediating. Whereas in the worship of Grama Devata in these villages, you would not find a priestly mediation. Usually, the goddess is addressed in the local vernacular with an accent on familial terminology. So most frequently, she is known in familial terms, such as mother or elder sister, or at times she's also addressed with the respectful and formal term, madam. In the instance of her transition into a Brahmanic deity, a Grama Devata might acquire the Sanskrit suffix, that is Amba or Ambika or Devi. You know, all these are, goddess or mother in respectful forms. The priests and priestesses of the Grama Devata are mostly from non-Brahmanic castes and play a major cultic role only at the time of special festivals. So these characteristics are usually typical. Although in fast-changing contemporary Andhra or even in larger Indian society, exceptions are quite common.
And so what does your book argue about Grama Devatas?
Okay, so I probably would, as a way to respond to your question, I will state four major takeaways that address some major misconceptions about fertility goddess. So I will take it from there. And you can ask me if that isn't answering the question. First, even if it is agreed that many agricultural societies, including India's, venerated fertility goddesses for centuries, given the popular orientation of the cult, the general scholarly understanding is that it is impossible to establish a coherent history about them. This book challenges this notion by tracing various transformations of fertility cult over millenniums. Secondly, the widespread understanding among scholarly circles is that the goddess is essentially a divine feminine. Through illustrations of art forms of various periods, this book expands the conception of goddess, directing reader to various manifestations of the goddess that include nature in its many aspects. A third misconception is India's emergent major religions have very little in common with the fertility goddess traditions. In this book, I make a case that fertility goddess traditions not only are inextricably intertwined with these Indic religions, but the goddess traditions enriched these religious traditions by providing them with an artistic vocabulary, a mythic imagination, and an opportunity to develop a rapport with the general village social and cultural milieu. One final but equally important takeaway from this book is the integral connection between the village goddess and human woman, presenting case studies of actual women of different ages who have been deified. I discuss in this book the ways female power is understood and processed and its ramifications on gender relations in Indian society.
So let's engage maybe the first of those. You talk about the antiquity or these sort of ancient, while you admit that one can't trace a coherent historical trajectory, you do trace these Grama Devatas back to very ancient times. Why don't you tell our listeners about that?
I think I will start with an example. So I have traced the village origins for goddesses famous for their Brahmanic affiliations in United Andhra Pradesh, such as Kanaka Durga of Vijayawada, Bhadrakali of Warangal, and Mahankali of Secunderabad. A close look at the background of Kanaka Durga through the study of inscriptions and iconograph forms displays an interesting mixture of various cults and historical transitions. A fertility goddess in the agricultural and household contexts was worshipped in her naked form. When the goddess was seen as the bringer and curer of diseases, or as a battle queen by rulers who adopted her as their guardian deity, she manifested ferocious forms and served the common people and the rulers in her respective attributes. The cults of two deified women were also merged into the cult of Kanaka Durga. From time to time, the goddess also incorporated aspects of the ferocious tribal cults, such as Durga, as illustrated in my book, and yet managed to retain relative independence even after becoming Brahmanic, in which context she is shown in pleasing countenance as the wife of Shiva. Somewhat similar history is shared by the goddess Bhadrakali of Warangal. A mixture of many goddess cults of Grama Devata and royal guardian deity from the 7th century, the ferocious form of Bhadrakali's stone image is softened by many measures, including breaking her protruding tongue before ceremoniously reinstalling it. Portraying pleasing forms of the Grama Devata can be attributed to the success of medical science in preventing communicable diseases for humans and domestic animals. Unlike in these two cases, the goddess Mahankali in Secunderabad does not possess any history of royal patronage. Neither this goddess was originally a local Grama Devata, but her cultic history traces the transition from Grama Devata to Brahmanic goddess. According to the temple lore, the cult was introduced a couple of centuries ago by a devotee of famous goddess Mahankali of Ujjaini in the former state of Madhya Pradesh. The goddess became so popular that a century or later or so, funds were raised to build a temple and install a newly made stone image with Vedic rituals by Brahmin priests. As I have explained in my book, there were many tribal cults in history that merged with Grama Devata cults as a part of assimilation of various tribal people with the mainstream village society at various points in time. Some of these entered the Hindu Brahmanical mainstream to become conflated with popular goddesses such as Durga and Kali, who themselves went through the same process. For example, for the last half century or so, tribal goddesses Samakka and Saraka in western Andhra, which is now part of newly formed Telangana state, have started to attract large Hindu populations. The Koyas are a hill tribe who traditionally live in the forest in Warangal district, which is now a tiger reserve, and who perform annual festivals to these goddesses following tribal rites. The popularity of this annual festival among Hindu devotees increased to such an extent that since 2010, the state government has been involved in bringing offerings to the goddess. The Hindu devotees not only brought many Brahmanic elements to the ritual, but started setting up the images of the goddesses in temples in other regions of Telangana to celebrate annual festivals. It is possible that this cult, like some tribal cults, will eventually merge as an extension of a Brahmanic cult. In fact, songs, videos, and a new Tollywood film have been made for the consumption of Hindu devotees who want to identify Samakka as Shakti, the preeminent goddess who rules the whole world. She is also, of course, identified as Shiva's wife and Vishnu's sister. The images distributed as Samakka also reflect an uncanny resemblance to the great goddess Durga. In this imagery, Samakka is riding a tiger and Saraka a stag.
So you link modern Grama Devatas to the Indus Valley context, do you not?
Yes, I do. In looking at symbols and tracing the symbols that how some of these symbols have been in use even in the contemporary rituals to the Grama Devata. I didn't mean to start from Indus Valley and try to force that connection to the Grama Devata. But as I've been examining, tracing the contemporary mythology, the rituals, the symbolism, and going through inscriptions, what we can learn and whether the form of Grama Devata worship existed in early times, and that brought me to the earliest period, prehistoric period in Andhra Pradesh, where I examined, I came across these symbols in burials of 4th century before Common Era. And those like symbols like swastika and srivatsa, all these symbols of the goddess are also seen, I realized, in Indus Valley seals and ceilings. That's how I am interested in these symbols and their connections. And and then in between Indus Valley period and 4th century before Common Era, you know, this post-Indus Valley times, what happened and how these symbols turn into kind of naked goddess. And the evolution can be seen in pictographic form, either sculptural representations or representations in coins. Then I trace that evolution. For example, I take a pot symbol for, you know, pot represents the womb of the goddess. So how this part is still in worship, you know, parts play an important role. Women carry parts full of water or parts with food on their heads to in goddess rituals in procession to bring them to the goddess, and they also act as representations. And on these parts, they also paint these symbols, swastika, srivatsa, etc. So this part is worshipped in part shape in the beginning, but then even in Indus Valley period, you see, and the part has legs showing those parts, you know, three different representations. You can see they also have face. part has a neck, natural neck, but over that neck, the neck is depicted as a face in Indo-Sales. And that happened again in early medieval times in Andhra Pradesh. You see sculptural representations. So slowly the part takes this anthropomorphic shape of the goddess. Almost towards the end, the head is the only one that's not represented in these evolution, but head was replaced by a lotus. And before it became completely a naked goddess. Even when she is represented as a naked goddess, is like a giving birth to a child, with flexed legs, still her head is like a lotus. And in 7th century, many of these images, stone images, were in worship, and there are inscriptions proving that. And some of these images, in fact, are worshipped even now. Which means the worship is continued without any broken line, like in Karnataka. There are many instances.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, it might be useful if you talk about these categories of Grama Devata versus popular goddess versus fertility goddess, and how you use them in the book, how they relate to each other in the history of Indian religion. You know, tell us about these categories.
Grama Devata, sometimes you cannot separate Grama Devata from a fertility goddess. Grama Devata actually is fertility goddess, with a few exceptions, I would say. I think by describing the characteristics of Grama Devata, you will understand the connection between fertility cult and Grama Devata, I guess. So various symbols used to represent the fertility goddess were the Grama Devata. So I used as synonymous fertility goddess and Grama Devata. But the way I used fertility goddess, the terminology is that fertility goddess in pre-modern times, because there was an argument, Grama Devata did not have any history. So I set to prove, yes, there was history. So what was she called? Was she called as Grama Devata? And who was she? So, and I have all these symbols that I was explaining. And this shows the fertility aspect of this goddess. So I termed that fertility goddess that in contemporary times we call Grama Devata. So otherwise, the Grama Devata present, who is fertility goddess, but we call fertility goddess in the past, that's for my use in my book. But the various symbols used to represent the fertility goddess still articulated by aspects of her current mythology reveal that the nature of the Grama Devata has been complex from the time of its known origins, possibly, as I said, as early as in Indo civilization. Moreover, the fact that the goddess seems consistently to have been conceived in paradoxical ways has produced a multi-purpose and adaptive cult. For example, because the Grama Devata has been understood essentially as a shapeless and even genderless procreative force, Her imagined forms reflect propensity to assume a presence in virtually any inanimate or animate beings that conform to a logic of association with her power. As such, the Gramadevata has often been imagined as a human female figure giving birth to nature, as a mother who bears the universe in her womb. In this sense, she is a creation as well as creator. She is also seen as capable of destroying what she creates. What is new in my study is that the symbols, images, and mythology of the ancient fertility goddess correlate with the contemporary understandings of the Gramadevata as a creator, nurturer, and destroyer. She may be worshipped as the body of the village, with her navel stone planted in the center of the village, or kept at a safe distance at the edge of the village. In the former instance, she brings fertility and prosperity to the villagers by bringing timely rains if worshipped properly. In the latter, she is a goddess of poxes or other forms of illnesses afflicting humans, domestic animals, birds, and crops who need to be appeased so that she will stay away. Whether she is a loving mother or a wrathful cow punishing villagers for their missteps, the Gramadevata remains an integral feature of village identity.
And how does this fit into this, what you call the popular goddess, or this sort of Brahmanical appropriation of these goddesses? Are they ultimately separate? I mean, you make an interesting argument in terms of how they relate.
Yes. They are separate, but they also evolved into Brahmanical goddesses. They still remain separate, most of them, but some of them became Brahmanical goddesses. Like I was talking about naked goddess, how the naked goddess evolved into Lakshmi, by Vaishnavites, how she was integrated as a goddess who is, I mean, in the beginning, you have Lakshmi figures, naked Lakshmi standing with elephants, flanked by two elephants pouring water on her. And this was early centuries, first century actually, before Common Era, And then even in Andhra, we have these goddess in the beginning trying to mediate between Saivites and Vaishnavites when they had trouble with each other. And then the goddess also is being transitioned. Vaishnavites were adopting her as the figure of decorating like Vishnu's chest as Srivatsa, a symbol. That symbol was adopted by Vaishnavites. And then Lakshmi, in her anthropomorphic form, still stays in his chest. Sometimes you can see just the Srivatsa mark. But anyway, so she becomes Lakshmi in Vaishnava imagery and Parvati in Saivite imagery. But as soon as goddess enters these traditions, she is clothed appropriately and so that it meets the standards of these traditions.
Is there anything else about this book that you would like to share in terms of its main takeaways?
I think I have mentioned the major takeaways to begin with, I guess. Yes, in the beginning, this is, as I said in one of the first takeaways, there was this assumption, which I said to challenge, and it was challenging to me as well when I start working, and I wasn't sure how much I will be successful in this attempt. But at the end, it was worthwhile at many levels, actually, in the sense that these various, not only, it came as a surprise to me when I was rebuilding the history of goddess, and I came to realize that how the goddess not only predated with all these traditions, but came to influence these Indic religions, such as Jainism, Buddhism, what we call Hinduism, the Vaishnavite, Saivite orientations. all these religions, you know, the God is influenced in many positive ways, you know, providing all these, you know, imagery, vocabulary to these religions. So that itself is a revelation even to me, as I, you know, I didn't realize. Two things I didn't realize. One is the connection all the way can go back to Indus times. Because a lot of times, you know, still a lot of scholars, or we are not sure, a lot of aspects that continued what we see in Indus times into later periods. So so we have to be really careful about trying to trace it to Indus period, and that not really proving the continuation. But in this sense, I see this clear continuity that, you know, started in Indus times. And that's one revelation. The second revelation is I didn't have any idea that God played a crucial role in the development of these Indic religions, especially Jainism and Buddhism. We see as ascetic religions, and you would think very little that connection with the goddess traditions. So those two are really surprising elements even to me when I was, you know, doing research. So I hope the readers also find that as a revelation.
Let's do a tiny thought experiment, if you'd like. Let's assume that you were charged with creating a course about the goddess, or we could say Shaktism, or the India's feminine divine, shall we say. Let's just say you're creating a course, whether it's or a lecture series, right? And your job is to present India's feminine divine to an audience, whether undergrads or continuing studies. I'm curious as to how you would organize it. Like for myself, I would have a unit probably on Vedic goddesses, mythology goddesses. I may have a unit on Tantra. I may have a unit on what I consider village goddesses or Grama Devatas, or popular goddesses. You know, it seems to me that, well, let me not beg the question. How would you organize a course on presenting India's goddess tradition, do you think?
Actually, I came to Harvard University as a research associate and visiting lecturer. The course I taught there was images of feminine. Actually, the basic question in that course was like, I guess it's very traditional. It became traditional, I guess, why the goddesses are elevated in Indian society or in Hindu society, and while the woman, at least assumed, are, you know, I guess it, to a large extent, it is true in all cultures, you know, subordinated. So that was the question I was exploring. So looking at, you know, these goddesses, various goddesses, and their, you know, as feminists in this, in the West, are so fascinated by the goddess Kali, who is a very powerful image. And then you have woman in a subordinated position. Naturally, that question crosses everybody's mind. So so I taught that course, and it was really, really fun. And, you know, like looking at some film and also looking at the early devotees like Andal, you know, these saints, and then these goddesses, and, you know, like... But that particular course, I taught many iterations of it. The last time I taught was last year at the University of Chicago. And I used my book as a theme this last time, and then arranged other readings to go with that theme. Because my book not only talks about the history of goddess symbols, and also case studies of and mythology of various goddesses, village goddesses, and case studies of the transition of these goddesses from village to urban setting or Sanskritized goddesses, how they enter these Indic traditions, big Indic traditions. But also I look at the deified woman of different ages, how sometimes these deified women match with the Grama Devata or village goddess cult, or sometimes stand out for themselves as deified. But what social issues they bring about, and how the, you know, what are the reasons behind this deification? Is this guilt? So I'm looking at this divine feminine on the one hand and human on the other, human feminine, how she is received in the society, and where this divinity starts, and where the humanity comes in play. So that was really very, very satisfying last year, and also it made a huge difference, like at Harvard or the University of Chicago, you have graduate students. So the level of discussion is much more refined. So you get more satisfaction, I guess. I do not know whether I answered all the question you have in mind.
I've said this before, I'll say it again. It's always about the scenic route to draw out themes of conversation. So there is no there is no finite answer to my questions. They're meant to be generative rather than comprehensive. So are you still working on the goddess? What are you working on now? Before we close, why don't you tell us about what you're working on?
I think this is very, very different research I've been doing in recent years. So I actually am involved in two research projects right now. Unlike my other research, the venue for these projects is in Sri Lanka, not in Andhra Pradesh, where I come from. But I also spent so much time in Sri Lanka that became my second or third home, whatever you call it, because America is my second home, then Sri Lanka becomes my third home, I guess. So I directed a study abroad program for 20 plus years. American undergrad program in Sri Lanka. So I worked with the staff. I worked with the university that we are affiliated with in Kandy. And I set courses. And so I developed a lot of relationships as well as understanding their culture and learning the language. So that brought me into Sri Lanka. And so the first research, full-fledged research project, I should say, because I published another book, was kind of fiction and historical fiction, is Fractured Bliss. But this first real full-fledged research project is a cultic history of Vibhishana, an important character in the Indian epic Ramayana. So I made considerable progress on this project. Unlike in India and Southeast Asia, where the epic is popular, in certain parts of Sri Lanka, Vibhishana is worshipped as a guardian deity. So far, I have published a couple of papers on different aspects of the Vibhishana cult. One of these two papers forms part of a special section of the Journal of South Asian Studies, which I have co-edited with the title Lankapura, the Legacy of the Ramayana in Sri Lanka. So that's my first project. The second project is, again, very different, an examination of the state of traditional medicine in Sri Lanka since colonial times to the present. So like in India, Sri Lanka has a variety of traditional medicine practitioners. Variety of traditional medicine is being practiced. So my research is focused on those practitioners whose families are in the traditional medicine for generations. I have interviewed a sample of these practitioners throughout the island to study the diverse medical traditions and also their complex histories. So that's what I'm trying to do right now.
Sounds interesting. Sounds fascinating. Particularly the project about the Vishnu. Now, they both sound fascinating. I might be slightly biased because any sense of narrative, but either way, I'm glad that you have no shortage of interests to pursue. And so I think we've taken enough of your time for one day. So we will close now. For those of you listening, we have been talking about the vicissitudes of the goddess, reconstructions of the Gramadevata in India's religious traditions. We've been talking with Dr. Sri Padma, who's a visiting professor at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Until next time, stay safe. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the Hindu goddess. Take care.